Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. A wise old English nobleman once said, "A happy family is but an earlier heaven." Amen to that. But really, who hasn't had to deal with sibling rivalry, contentious teens, quirky in-laws, aging parents, and the list goes on. Family is at the core of everyone's story, yet how amazingly they vary. Today, we'll focus on new fiction with families at the heart of the story. Among the books we'll preview are Anne Tyler's latest title and Oprah's new book club pick. My guest today, Dave Barry, is famous for his unique worldview of family interaction. Dave stops by to speak about his brand new title, Live Right and Find Happiness, although beer is much faster. Great title, Dave. Can't wait to find out more. So let's begin as we turn to page one of the book report. It was a beautiful, breezy, yellow and green afternoon. That's the way Abby Whitshank always began the story of how she fell in love with red that day in July 1959. The Whitshanks are at the core of Anne Tyler's acclaimed new novel, A Spool of Blue Thread. The Whitshanks are one of those families that radiate togetherness. But they are also like all families. Abby and Red and their four grown children have accumulated not only tender moments, but also jealousies, disappointments, and carefully guarded secrets. From Red's father and mother, newly arrived in Baltimore in the 1920s, to Abby and Red's grandchildren carrying the family legacy into the 21st century, this is the story of four generations of Whitshanks, their lives unfolding in and around the sprawling, lovingly worn Baltimore house that has always been their anchor. Kimberly Farr narrates.
"We have to find him," she said. Then, "We should have that, what's it, caller ID." She leaned forward and gazed fiercely at the phone. "Oh, God, I want caller ID this instant."
"What for? So you could phone him back and he could just let it ring?"
"He wouldn't do that. He would know it was me. He would answer if he knew it was me."
She jumped up from the bed and started pacing back and forth, up and down the Persian runner that was worn nearly white in the middle from all the time she had pasted before. This was an attractive room, spacious and well-designed, but it had the comfortably shabby air of a place whose inhabitants had long ago stopped seeing it.
"What did his voice sound like?" she asked. "Was he nervous? Was he upset?"
"He was fine."
"So you say. Had he been drinking, do you think?"
"I couldn't tell."
"Were other people with him?"
"I couldn't tell, Abby."
"Or maybe one other person?"
He sent her a sharp look. "You are not thinking he was serious," he said.
"Of course he was serious. Why else would he say it?"
"The boy isn't gay, Abby."
"How do you know that?"
"He just isn't. Mark my words. You're going to feel silly by and by, like, shoot, I overreacted."
"Well, naturally, that is what you would want to believe."
"Doesn't your female intuition tell you anything at all? This is a kid who got a girl in trouble before he was out of high school."
"So? That doesn't mean a thing. It might even have been a symptom."
"Come again?"
"We can never know with absolute certainty what another person's sex life is like."
"No, thank God," Red said. He bent over with a grunt and reached beneath the bed for his slippers. Abby, meanwhile, had stopped pacing and was staring once more at the phone. She set a hand on the receiver. She hesitated. Then she snatched up the receiver and pressed it to her ear for half a second before slamming it back down.
"The thing about caller ID is,"
Red said, more or less to himself, "it seems a little like cheating. A person should be willing to take his chances answering the phone. That's kind of the general idea with phones, is my opinion." He heaved himself to his feet and started toward the bathroom.
Behind him, Abby said, "This would explain so much, wouldn't it, if he should turn out to be gay?" Red was closing the bathroom door by then, but he poked his head back out to glare at her. His fine black eyebrows, normally straight as rulers, were knotted almost together. "Sometimes," he said, "I rue and deplore the day I married a social worker." Then he shut the door very firmly. When he returned, Abby was sitting upright in bed with her arms clamped across the lace bosom of her nightgown. "You are surely not going to try and blame Denny's problems on my profession," she told him.
"I'm just saying a person can be too understanding," he said. "Too sympathizing and pitying-like, getting into a kid's private brain."
"There is no such thing as too understanding."
"Well, count on a social worker to think that."
She gave an exasperated puff of a breath, and then she sent another glance toward the phone. It was on Red's side of the bed, not hers. Red raised the covers and got in, blocking her view. He reached over and snapped off the lamp on the nightstand. The room fell into darkness, with just a faint glow from the two tall, gauzy windows overlooking the front lawn.
We've just heard A Spool of Blue Thread by Ann Tyler. Kristen Hannah's The Nightingale is set in France, 1939. Vianne says goodbye to her husband Antoine as he heads for the front. She doesn't believe the Nazis will invade France, but they come. In droves of marching soldiers, caravans of trucks and tanks, in planes that fill the sky and drop bombs on the innocent. When a German captain requisitions Vianne's home, she and her daughter must live with the enemy or lose everything. Without food, money, or hope, she's forced to make one impossible choice after another to keep her family alive. Vianne's sister, Isabel, is a rebellious 18-year-old searching for purpose with all the passion of youth. Isabel joins the resistance and never looks back, risking her life time and again. The Nightingale captures the epic panorama of World War II and illuminates an intimate part of history seldom seen, the Women's War. Polly Stone performs the book.
Her 8-year-old daughter was probably running through the house, making her father dance attendance on her as they readied for their Saturday picnic.
"Your daughter is a tyrant," Antoine said, appearing in the doorway.
He walked toward her, his pomaded hair glinting black in the sunlight. He'd been working on his furniture this morning, sanding a chair that was already as soft as satin, and a fine layer of wood dust peppered his face and shoulders. He was a big man, tall and broad-shouldered, with a rough face and a dark stubble that took constant effort to keep from becoming a beard. He slipped an arm around her and pulled her close.
"I love you, V."
"I love you, too." It was the truest fact of her world. She loved everything about this man, his smile, the way he mumbled in his sleep and laughed after a sneeze and sang opera in the shower. She'd fallen in love with him 15 years ago, on the school playyard, before she'd even known what love was. He was her first everything. First kiss, first love, first lover. Before him, she'd been a skinny, awkward, anxious girl, given to stuttering when she got scared, which was often. A motherless girl.
"You will be the adult now,"
her father had said to Vianne as they walked up to this very house for the first time. She'd been 14 years old, her eyes swollen from crying, her grief unbearable. In an instant, this house had gone from being the family summer house to a prison of sorts. Maman had been dead less than 2 weeks when Papa gave up on being a father. Upon their arrival here, he'd not held her hand, or rested a hand on her shoulder, or even offered her a handkerchief to dry her tears. just a girl, she'd said.
Not anymore.
She'd looked down at her younger sister, Isabel, who still sucked her thumb at 4 and had no idea what was going on. Isabel kept asking when Maman was coming home. When the door opened, a tall, thin woman with a nose like a water spigot and eyes as small and dark as raisins appeared.
These are the girls, the woman had said.
Papa nodded.
There will be no trouble.
It had happened so fast. Vian hadn't really understood. Papa dropped off his daughters like soiled laundry and left them with a stranger. The girls were so far apart in age, it was as if they were from different families. Vian had wanted to comfort Isabel, meant to, but Vian had been in so much pain it was impossible to think of anyone else, especially a child as willful and impatient and loud as Isabel. Vian still remembered those first days here. Isabel shrieking and Madame spanking her. Vian had pleaded with her sister, saying again and again,
Mon Dieu, Isabel, quit screeching. Just do as she bids.
But even at 4, Isabel had been unmanageable. Vian had been undone by all of it, the grief for her dead mother, the pain of her father's abandonment, the sudden change in their circumstances, and Isabel's cloying, needy loneliness. It was Antoine who'd saved Vian. That first summer, after Maman's death, the two of them had become inseparable. With him, Vian had found an escape. By the time she was 16, she was pregnant. At 17, she was married and the mistress of Le Jardin. 2 months later, she had a miscarriage, and she lost herself for a while. There was no other way to put it. She'd crawled into her grief and cocooned it around her, unable to care about anyone or anything. Certainly not a needy, wailing 4-year-old sister.
That was Nightingale by Kristen Hanna. Yellow Crocus by Leila Ibrahim is a deeply moving tale of unlikely love. Moments after Lisbeth is born, she's taken from her mother and handed over to Maddie, an enslaved wet nurse who's been separated from her own infant son to care for her tiny charge. Thus begins an intense relationship that will shape both of their lives for decades to come. Though Lisbeth leads a life of privilege, she finds nothing but loneliness in the company of her overwhelmed mother and her distant slave-owning father. As she grows older, Maddie becomes more like family to Lisbeth than her own kin. But can two women in such disparate circumstances form a bond like theirs without consequence? Bonnie Turpin performs the story of the journey of these very different women as each searches for freedom and dignity.
Remember, Rebecca gonna feed him when he get hungry, she reminded him, though he was well aware of the plan. He was patient with her, as always.
Don't you worry about him. You just be careful in there.
He patted her dark brown arm. She stared into Poppy's eyes and hoped he understood all that she did not say. She wanted to know that her son would be well cared for, that he would be told she had not chosen to leave him, and that when she returned, he would know that she was his mother. But Maddie said nothing. She did not scream in protest or plead for more time. Instead, she turned away in silence, blinking back tears as she left her home and abandoned her son. She had no choice. She had to be strong, get through this separation, and return to Samuel as soon as possible. Whether that would be in months or years, she had no way of knowing. Maddie shivered as she followed the dim light cast by Emily's oil lamp. They walked toward the big house, a path she had learned to dread and which she rarely traveled. How long she been having pains? Maddie asked as they passed the small brick cookhouse.
Most of the day, I think. She starts screaming after dinner.
Her water show yet?
Don't know.
the girl replied as they reached the rear of the big house. They entered through a painted door and climbed up the worn back stairs to the second floor. Maddie had never been inside this building and had no reason to expect that she ever would be until a few days ago. Field hands did not go into the big house. She did not know why they picked her over her sister Rebecca to feed this new baby. It was not her place to ask or argue with the white folks. She did as she was told. Nervously, Maddie stepped behind Emily along a soft, colorful rug, going down the smooth white hallway past several polished doors. Emily stopped in front of the last door on the left.
"They waiting in there for you,"
she informed Maddie, pointing. Maddie watched the girl's mouth open wide in a yawn. Then Emily turned and made her way back down the corridor. Maddie's heart beat fiercely as she stood alone and uncertain in the long hallway. Suddenly, the white door flew open. She jumped back in time to avoid being trampled by a figure rushing out. Warm air tinged with the smell of sweat wafted out of the room. Hesitating at the threshold, Maddie peered into the dim chamber. A petite white woman with skin the color of heavy cream lay in a large bed. Eyes closed to the world, she moaned loudly. Her damp, dark hair stuck to her sweaty, swollen face. The woman's features contorted and she cried out in pain. Her eyes squeezed shut so tightly that her lashes disappeared, and her mouth was pulled in so hard that her lips hid in the cave of her mouth. "There you are," proclaimed one of the two women hovering around the bed. The large white woman with narrow blue eyes and gray hair pulled into a severe bun pointed to a chair in the corner of the room. "We are not yet in need of you. Complications." She trailed off without a complete explanation. "Go sit in the chair, and do not do anything to upset your mistress." Maddie moved into the room as quietly as possible and made herself small to avoid drawing the attention of the red-faced man looming over the foot of the bed. She lowered herself into a plush velvet armchair and unconsciously rubbed the smooth pile with the tips of her brown fingers. Her gaze flew around the room, taking it in. Mrs. Anne, the mistress of the house, was in the intricately carved four-poster bed that took up much of the space. Next to it sat a marble-topped wash basin covered with crumpled cloths. The man directed the two women poised on either side of the bed.
"Hold her down when I'm ready to pull the infant out," he commanded. "Prevent all movement, or they both may die."
We've just heard Yellow Crocus by Leila Ibrahim. Bond's Ruby is the story of a man determined to protect the woman he loves from the town desperate to destroy her. Oprah has chosen this title as her new book club select. Ephraim Dennings has never forgotten the beautiful girl with the long braids running through the woods of Liberty, their small East Texas town. Young Ruby, the kind of pretty it hurt to look at, has suffered beyond imagining. So, as soon as she can, she flees Liberty for the bright pole of New York in the 1950s. Ruby quickly winds her way into the center of the city, the darkened piano bars and hidden alleyways of the village, all the while hoping for a glimpse of the red hair and green eyes of her mother. When a telegram from her cousin forces her to return home, 30-year-old Ruby Bell finds herself reliving the devastating violence of her girlhood. Meanwhile, Ephraim must choose between loyalty to the sister who raised him and the chance for a life with the woman he loves. The author narrates.
Ruby Bell was a constant reminder of what could befall a woman whose shoe heels were too high. The people of Liberty Township wove her into cautionary tales of the wages of sin and travel. They called her buck crazy, howling half-naked mad. The fact that she had come back from New York City made this somewhat understandable to the town. She wore gray like rain clouds and wandered the red roads in bared feet, calluses thick as boot leather. hair caked with mud, blackened nails as if she had scratched the slate of night. Her acres of legs carrying her, arms swaying like a loose screen, her eyes the ink of sky just before the storm. That is how Ruby walked when she lived in the splintered house that Papa Bell had built before he passed. When she dug into the East Texas soil under moonlight and wailed like a distant train. In those years, after her return, people let Ruby be. They walked a curved path to avoid her door. And so it was more than strange when someone walked the length of Liberty and brought a covered cake to the Bell's front porch. Ephraim Jennings had seen the gray woman passing like a haint through the center of town since she'd returned to Bell Land in 1963. All of Liberty had. He had seen her wipe the spittle from her jerking lips, run her still beautiful hands over the crust of her hair each day before she'd turn the corner in view of the town. He'd seen her walking like she had some place she ought to have been, then 5 steps away from P&K Market, stand pillar still, her rain cloud body shaking. Ephraim had seen Miss P, the proprietor of the store, walk nonchalantly out of her door and say, "Honey, can you see if I got the rise in these rolls right?" Ephraim watched Ruby stare past her, but take the brown sack filled with steaming yeast bread. Take it and walk away with her acres of legs carrying her, while Miss P said, "You come on back tomorrow, Ruby Bell, and help me out if you get the chance." Ephraim Jennings had watched this for 11 years, seen her black-bottomed foot kick a swirl of dust in its wake. Every day he wanted nothing more than to put each tired soul in his wide wooden tub, brush them both in warm, soapy water, cream them with sweet oil and lanolin, and then slip her feet, one by one, into a pair of red heel socks. But instead, with each passing year, he watched Miss P do her Christian duty from the corner of his eye, watched the gray woman stoop to accept the doughy alms. He sat alongside the crowd of men parked on their stools outside P&K, who read their papers, played dominoes, and chewed tobacco, toothpicks dangling, pipes smoking, soda pops sweating, just as they had the day Ruby arrived back in Liberty. When she'd stepped from the red bus, the porch had crowded her with their eyes. Hair pressed and gleaming like polished black walnut, lipstick red and thick, her cornflower blue sundress darted and stitched tight to her waist. Ephraim had watched her light a cigarette and glare down at the crowd on the market porch. They had all watched steadily as she slipped into madness. Concern, mingled with a secret satisfaction, melted into the creases of their bodies like Vaseline. After a time, they barely glanced up from their papers when Ruby walked up to the market. They yawned her existence away or spit out a wad of tobacco juice to mark her arrival. A low joke might rumble as Miss P handed over her bread, followed by throaty chuckles.
We've just heard Ruby by Cynthia Bond. Set in Wexford, Ireland, Cullum Tobin's superb seventh novel introduces the formidable, memorable, and deeply moving Nora Webster. Widowed at 40 with 4 children and not enough money, Nora has lost the love of her life, the man who rescued her from the stifling world to which she was born. Wounded, strong-willed, clinging to secrecy in a tiny community where everyone knows your business, Nora is drowning in her own sorrow and blind to the suffering of her young sons. Yet, she has moments of stunning empathy and kindness. And when she begins to sing again, after decades, she finds solace, engagement, and a haven in herself. Fiona Shaw performs Nora's story of navigating grief and struggling for hope.
She stopped and pursed her lips, as though she were trying to remember something. Suddenly she began to imitate a man's voice.
"Oh, and that's where I'm from," the man said. And then Tony said she was from Enniscorthy. "Oh, and that's where I'm from too," the man said. And he asked Tony what part of Enniscorthy she was from, and Tony said she was from Friary Street. May Lacey kept her eyes fixed on Nora's face, forcing her to express interest and surprise. "And the man said, that's where I'm from too. Isn't that extraordinary?" She stopped, waiting for a reply. "And he told Tony that before he left the town, he made that iron thing, what would you call it, a grill or a guard on the windowsill there at Jerry Crane's. And I went down to look at it, and it's there all right. Jerry didn't know how it got there or when. But the man beside Tony in the bed in Brooklyn, he said that he made it. He was a welder. Isn't that a coincidence? To happen in Brooklyn." Nora made tea as Donal went to bed. She brought it into the back room on a tray with biscuits and cake. When they'd fussed over the tea things, May Lacey sipped her tea and began to talk again. "Of course, all of mine thought the world of Morris. They always asked for him in their letters. He was friends with Jack before Jack left, and of course Morris was a great teacher. The boys looked up to him. I always heard that said." Looking into the fire, Nora tried to think back, wondering if May Lacey had ever been in this house before. She thought not. She had known her all her life, like so many in the town, to greet and exchange pleasantries with, or to stop and talk to if there was news. She knew the story of her life, down to her maiden name, and the plot in the graveyard where she would be buried. Nora had heard her singing once at a concert. She remembered her reedy soprano. It was "Home, Sweet Home," or "Oft in the Stilly Night," at one of those songs. She did not think that May Lacey went out much except to shop or to Mass on Sundays. They were silent now, and Nora thought that maybe May would go soon. "It's nice of you to come up and see me," she said. "Oh, Nora, I was very sorry for you, but felt I'd wait. I didn't want to be crowding in on you."
She refused more tea, and when Nora went to the kitchen with a tray, she thought that May might stand up and put on her coat. But she did not move from the chair. Nora went upstairs and checked that the boys were asleep. She smiled to herself at the thought of going to bed herself now, falling asleep and leaving May Lacey down below, staring into the fire, waiting for her in vain.
"Where are the girls?" May asked as soon as Nora sat down. "I never see them now. They used to pass up and down all the time."
"Oinia is in school in Bunclody. She's settling in there now," Nora said. "And Fiona is doing her teacher training in Dublin."
"You'd miss them when they go away," May Lacey said. "I miss them all, I do, but it's funny. Of all of them, it's Eily I think about most, although I miss Jack too. There was something, I don't know. I just didn't want to lose Eily. I thought after Rose died, you know all this, Nora, that she would come home and stay and she'd find some sort of job here, and then one day, when she was just back a week or two, I noticed her all quiet and it wasn't like her, and she started to cry at the table, and that's when we heard the news that her fella in New York wouldn't let her come home unless she married him. And she had married him there without telling any of us. Well, that's that Eily then, I said. You'll have to go back to him, so. And I couldn't face her or speak to her. And she sent me photographs of him and her together in New York, but I couldn't look at them.
They were the last thing in the world I wanted to see. But I was always sorry she didn't stay.
That was Nora Webster by Colm Tobin. Next up on the book report, Vanessa and Her Sister, a new title from Priya Parmar that's perfect for fans of The Paris Wife and Loving Frank. London, 1905. The city is alight with change, and the Stevens siblings are at the forefront. Vanessa, Virginia, Toby, and Adrian leave behind their childhood home and take a house in the heart of avant-garde Bloomsbury. There, they bring together a glittering circle of bright, outrageous artistic friends who will grow into legend and come to be known as the Bloomsbury Group. And at the center of this charmed circle are the devoted, gifted sisters, Vanessa, the painter, and Virginia Woolf, the writer. But the landscape shifts when Vanessa unexpectedly falls in love and her sister feels dangerously abandoned. Eerily possessive, charismatic, manipulative, and brilliant, Virginia has always lived in the shelter of Vanessa's constant attention and encouragement. Without it, she careens towards self-destruction and madness. As tragedy threatens to destroy the family, Vanessa must decide if it is finally time to protect her own happiness above all else. An ensemble cast performs the book.
He left to write to Virginia, who has finished her rest cure and has begun a walking tour with Miss Thomas. Virginia wrote letter after letter complaining of this woman and then went on holiday with her. Strange. And I know babies often lose weight just after they are born, but Gratian is losing too much. He is spindly, frail, worried. 24th of August, 1910, 46 Gordon Square, 10 a.m. Hadrian, Saxon offered. He had been sitting in the corner with Gibbon's Latin dictionary for the last 3 hours. No, I said, annoyed by the subject. I am not up out of bed, but visitors are flocking in and out of my bedroom. Pausanias? No, Saxon. Adrian and Duncan had left for lunch, and Clive was off, most likely penning another letter to Virginia. Vigo? The baby's name is not sitting well with anyone, including the baby. I must come up with something else. Julian was such a Julian when he was born. His name settled on him like a wave on the shore. Gratian is bumpy and loose, and not settling on my new baby at all. Later. Clive, you cannot just disappear, I hissed at him. The house had not emptied. Saxon, Adrian, Duncan, Maynard, Desmond, Aunt Annie, Molly, and Snow were all downstairs. Lytton is still in Sweden for his health cure, and Morgan left to dine with his publisher, but will be back tonight. Gerald and George and George's wife Margaret are due any minute and will be appalled by the collection of buggers in the drawing room. I needed Clive to stay and keep all the social feathers from ruffling, but he kept vanishing up to his study or out to meet art dealers or out to meet Mrs. Ravenhill, for all I knew. I didn't disappear. I've been cooped up in the house for days, Clive said irritably. You have dozens of people to help you. What do you need me for? Clive, we have guests, lots of guests, and I want you to be the host. I cannot get out of bed and cannot control the rumpus downstairs. Could you please do that for me? These people are driving me mad, Nessa, Clive complained, dropping heavily into a fraying armchair. I am leaving for Paris in a few weeks. I am meant to be helping Roger organize the exhibition. Desmond does not have the least idea about how to put this all together. I have things to do. But Desmond is acting as secretary for Roger for the exhibition, Clive interrupted. He is helping collect the paintings, set the commissions, that sort of thing.
We've just heard Vanessa and Her Sister by Priya Parmar. For many years, my friend and professional humorist Dave Barry wrote a newspaper column that appeared in more than 500 newspapers. As he tells it, the column generated thousands of letters from readers. who thought he should be fired. Despite this, Dave won the Pulitzer Prize for commentary. One of Dave's columns was largely responsible for the movement to observe International Talk Like a Pirate Day every year on September 19th. As Dave sees it, this is probably his most enduring achievement. Dave has written more than 30 books, including the novels Big Trouble, Lunatics, Tricky Business, and most recently, Insane City. He's also written a number of books with titles like I'll Mature When I'm Dead, which are technically classified as nonfiction, although they contain numerous lies. Today we'll chat with Dave about his new title, Live Right and Find Happiness. Welcome, Dave. I'm thrilled to have you with us again on the Book Report.
Elaine, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
I know you do exhaustive research before putting pen to paper. Did you happen to uncover the number of other bestsellers that have the word beer in their subtitle?
No. Is there a large genre? I know, like, okay, Dostoevsky wrote War and Beer. No, that was supposedly. And then Melville wrote Moby Beer. I'm running out of. Oh, Marcel Proust, of course.
Oh.
Remembrance of Beer Past.
Right. In a career as prestigious as yours, you've met hundreds of famous folks. Can you share your experience of meeting Dick Cheney?
Yeah, I am. This is an object lesson in why you should not drink too much unless you're with good friends. Because you tend to think, at least I tend to think, that I'm much more amusing than I really am. And this is one of those things. It was a small gathering at the Washington Post, maybe two dozen people, and it was mostly cartoonists and me and Ted Koppel, and then they had as the guest of honor, then Secretary of Defense Dick Cheney. And so, again, small room, small gathering, and an open bar. And so I had a couple of beers. I meet Dick Cheney, and, you know, stick your hand out, shake hands, you know, Secretary Cheney, it's nice to meet you. Do that little ritual. Then a little while later, we kind of bump into each other, and I, without thinking, stick my hand out again, and he reflexively sticks his hand out again. And we did it again, and then we both realized, oh, we already did this, and we get a little bit sheepish, you know. But I thought that, you know, he just thought, okay, he's an idiot. I thought, wow, that was pretty funny. I'm going to do that again. So, like, about 2 minutes later, I deliberately go up and say, Secretary Cheney, Dave Barry, and, you know, now, you know, he's not so amused. And so, of course, I did it again. I'm sure he's looking around for the guy, you know, he's looking for his sniper to take me out, or he's going to take me quail hunting. I don't know. But anyway, if he's listening, and I know he is, Secretary Cheney, Vice President Cheney, I apologize. I was an idiot. I will never shake your hand again without it being a good reason.
All right. In the book, you seek to uncover blatant lies, like the ones perpetrated by Home Depot.
Home Depot runs these ads, which should be illegal, or they should carry a warning the way they do with the drugs, where they suggest that people can do things themselves. Like they'll typically show a cheerful homeowner couple, and they're at Home Depot and they're looking at like tile samples, and then there's a short scene where they're wearing safety goggles and screwing in a screw. And then the next thing you know, they have a whole new kitchen. And I'm saying, that is not the way it's actually going to happen. And they should have, like, a disclaimer, those ads. You know, this cheerful couple is actually, they're actors. They can't do it themselves. They can't make a kitchen themselves. They can't even make coffee themselves. If you need a kitchen, you're going to have to hire people with trucks to come do it for you.
Good advice. I loved reading about your experiences in Brazil when you went to see the World Cup. Dave, answer honestly. On any given Sunday afternoon, would you choose to watch a soccer game over American football?
Yes. I have become a big fan of soccer over the years. And I know that's like you're not supposed to, you're supposed to feel if you're an American. But if you analyze the two sports, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with football, but people always say that, you know, the problem with soccer is there's not enough action. And the truth is, in soccer, they pretty much never stop running around, except for when they fall down and pretend to be injured, which I admit they do a lot, but there's a lot of action. Whereas in American football, it's mostly they're holding meetings, which we call huddles, but they don't. There's a lot of meeting going on during which you see replays. And then, you know, then the typical play lasts 3 seconds and it involves everybody on the field falling down. When my daughter, Sophie, was around two, she and I remember, I'll never forget, we were watching a football game together, and Sophie got the hang of it after a while and started doing this play-by-play, like when they would form up at the line of scrimmage, she'd go, ready? And then they'd run the play, and she'd go, fall down! And I'm thinking, like, that describes a great deal of a football game. Ready? Fall down. Ready? Fall down.
Well, speaking of Sophie, you write 2015 is the year when she will get her learner's permit. How will you teach her to navigate South Florida roads?
Well, I'm really disturbed about this because the South Florida roads are no place for teenagers. They're really no place for anybody. They're incredibly dangerous. We have people driving, as I always say, a lot of people driving according to the laws of their country of origin. Then we have a lot of seniors driving here, and they're using, a lot of them, what I call the seeing eye wife method of driving, where the man is driving because the man drives, but he can no longer see, which is, you know, let's be honest, a pretty important component of the driving skill. So his wife is sitting next to him doing the seeing and conveying to him by yelling what she sees. Let's yellow. No, it's red. Stop. No, go. It's green. Go. You know, that kind of. So anyway, this is, my daughter's going to be out there driving. And what troubles me is that she's studying the Florida driver's manual, which is full of lies. I mean, you can't, it says, for example, in the Florida driver's manual, that if there's no posted speed limit, you should go 35 miles an hour. And you know, I want to tell us, like, if you go 35 miles an hour in Miami, they're going to shoot at you. So I have a realistic driver's manual in the book that explains to Sophie how people actually drive in Florida. Like, if you see somebody's turn signal on in Florida, what that means is that's the driver's way of letting you know that he or she doesn't know that his turn signal is on.
We're speaking with Dave Barry on the Book Report. You and Ridley Pearson visited Russia as a guest of the U.S. State Department as part of their American Writers Program. How did that go for you?
Well, the idea behind this program is to improve relations between the U.S. and Russia. We see how well that's working out. We just hope to God they don't send Ridley and me to Iran next. It was interesting. They had warned us that we would be under surveillance over there, including maybe even in our hotel rooms. But we had an interesting time. I would say the main thing I learned in my trip to Russia is if you go to Russia, do not eat the Mexican food, which I made the mistake of doing. There was a Mexican restaurant run by Russians near our hotel in Moscow. We went there and ate one night, and they really don't have a flair for Mexican food, the Russians. And I ate what I later came to believe was a weaponized chimichanga, and ended up in severe intestinal distress. And all I would say is, if the Russians were conducting surveillance of our rooms, I really pity the Russian who was listening into my room. Years of psychotherapy.
I'm sorry, Dave. But I was amazed to read that the Russians have the ability to control the weather. Were you making this up?
No. We arrived on Moscow City Day, which is basically the anniversary of the founding of Moscow. It's a big holiday in Moscow every year, and the weather was beautiful. We had been led to, you know, we were expecting gray skies and snow and sleet. It was nice. It was lovely. And the woman taking us around said, no, the government does that. They drop stuff into the clouds. And I didn't believe her, so I looked it up on the Internet, and we can't trust the Internet. Who can we trust? But the Russian government actually is quite proud of this, and they wrote a couple of articles about it. They dump chemicals into the clouds in huge quantities on days when they want the weather to be nice, and it works. The clouds go away. There's bright sunshine in Moscow when they have their big parades. That's apparently not great for the environment, but they don't care about that. They're Russians, you know. And so I thought, wouldn't it be great if city of Miami, where I live, could control the weather? We could control, maybe make the hurricanes go away. But then it occurred to me that if Miami could control the weather, we would probably use it to attack Cuba.
Would it be safe to say the birth of your first grandchild was the motivation to write this book on life lessons?
I don't know if it was the motivation, but it certainly was a major major part of the book. I am a grandfather now, and I wanted to write a letter to my grandson, Dylan, conveying to him the wisdom that I've acquired in my 67 years. You know, and I thought, well, what have I learned that is really true and really I think is important to pass along to the next generation? And the one lesson that I really believe in that I pass along is that you do not need to refrigerate ketchup. many people do, and they don't need to. And my argument is if you go into a restaurant, where's the ketchup? It's on the table. It's been there like for all day, maybe all week, maybe for several years in certain restaurants. That's where they keep the ketchup. And you never say, waiter, bring me some cold ketchup to put on my hamburger.
Dave, any final thoughts on Live Right and Find Happiness?
Only that it's available in bookstores everywhere, here and on other planets, in exchange for money.
And I'm going to tell the readers that it is money well spent. Dave, thanks a million for joining us today.
Elaine, it's been my pleasure.
Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Live Right and Find Happiness, performed by Dave himself.
She leaves. Draper lights another cigarette and pours himself another glass of whiskey. Secretary on intercom. Mr. Draper, some of your fellow executives are here to talk to you. Draper. About what? Secretary. Advertising. Draper. Advertising? Secretary. Yes, you're an advertising executive. Draper. Oh, right, I forgot. Send them in. Several executives enter. Draper pours them drinks. They all light cigarettes. Executive. Don, we need to sell some advertising. Draper. Okay. Hey, one of you is a woman. They have extramarital sex. And so on. If Mad Men really is authentic, it explains much about the TV commercials of my childhood, which in terms of intellectual content, make the commercials of today look like Citizen Kane. Back then, many commercials featured a male authority figure in the form of an actor pretending to be a doctor or scientist. Sometimes, to indicate how authoritative he wore a white lab coat. The male authority figure usually spoke directly to the camera, sometimes using charts or diagrams to explain important scientific facts, such as that certain brands of cigarettes could actually soothe your throat, or that Anacin could stop all three known medical causes of headaches. 1. Electrical bolts inside your head. 2. A big coiled spring inside your head. 3. A hammer pounding inside your head. Another standard character in those old commercials, providing contrast to the male authority figure, was the desperately insecure housewife, who was portrayed by an actress in a dress. The desperately insecure housewife was always close to suicide because she had some hideous inadequacy as a homemaker. Her coffee was bitter, her laundry detergent was ineffective against stains, her meatloaf failed to excite her family, she had odors emanating from her carpet, etc. She was under tremendous stress. She couldn't even escape to the bathroom without being lectured on commode sanitation by a tiny man rowing a rowboat around inside her toilet tank. Even back then, everybody thought these commercials were stupid. But it wasn't until years later, when I started watching Mad Men, that I realized why they were so stupid. The people making them were so drunk they had the brain functionality of road salt. First ad executive, I got it. We put a tiny man in a rowboat in the toilet tank. Second ad executive, perfect. Pass the whiskey. But here's the thing. Despite all the drinking and sex on Mad Men, nobody ever seems to have any fun. The characters are almost universally miserable. And that, to me, does not seem authentic. I grew up during the Mad Men era. My family, like many of the Mad Men characters, lived in Westchester County, New York. In our case, the village of Armonk. Most of the moms of Armonk back then were housewives. Many of the dads, mine was one, rode the train to work in New York City. Some of those dads, including friends of my parents, were advertising executives. So during my childhood, I got to watch a sliver of the Mad Men generation as they went through their late 20s, into their 30s and 40s, raising their kids, pursuing their careers, and in some cases becoming very successful. Like the Mad Men characters, they smoked a lot and drank a lot, including at work. I don't know how much extramarital sex went on, and I don't want to know. But I do know this. Unlike the Mad Men characters, the grown-ups back then had fun. A lot of fun. And it didn't stop just because they had kids. My parents had a large circle of friends, and just about every weekend throughout my childhood, they had cocktail parties, which rotated from house to house. I loved it when the party was at our house. Dozens of cars filled our driveway and lined the narrow dirt road we lived on, and dozens of couples poured into the house. The men in suits and ties, the women in dresses and heels, everybody talking, shouting, laughing, eating hors d'oeuvres, smoking, heading to the lineup of bottles on the kitchen counter to pour another drink.
That was a sampling of Live Right and Find Happiness by Dave Barry. From Nick Hornby, best-selling author of High Fidelity, About a Boy, and A Long Way Down, comes the highly anticipated Funny Girl, his first novel since 2009. Set in 1960s London, Funny Girl is a lively account of the adventures of an intrepid young woman as she navigates her transformation from provincial ingenue to TV starlet. Insightful and humorous, Hornby's latest does what he does best, endears us to a cast of characters who are funny, yet wonderfully flawed. Emma Fielding will delight you with her narration.
It was Auntie Marie, her father's sister, who suggested that she should go in for Miss Blackpool. Marie came round for tea one Saturday afternoon, because she happened to be passing, and casually dropped the competition into the conversation, and, a sudden thought, asked her why she'd never had a go, while her dad sat there nodding his head and pretending to be thunderstruck by the brilliance of the idea. Barbara was puzzled for the first minute or two, before she realised that the two of them had cooked up a plan. The plan, as far as she could work out, was this. Barbara entered the pageant, won it, and then forgot all about moving to London because there'd be no need. She'd be famous in her own hometown, and who could want for more? And then she could have a go at Miss UK, and if that didn't work out, she could just think about getting married when there would be another coronation of sorts. And that was a part of the beauty pageant plan too, Barbara was sure. Marie was quite sniffy about Aidan, thought she could do much better, or much richer, anyway, and beauty queens could take their pick. Dottie Harrison had married a man who owned 7 carpet shops, and she'd only come 3rd. Barbara knew she didn't want to be queen for a day, or even for a year. She didn't want to be a queen at all. She just wanted to go on television and make people laugh. Queens were never funny. Not the ones in Blackpool, anyway, or the ones in Buckingham Palace, either. She'd gone along with Auntie Marie's scheme, though, because Dorothy L'Amour had been Miss New Orleans and Sophia Loren had been a Miss Italy runner-up. Barbara had always wanted to see a photograph of the girl who had beaten Sophia Loren. And she'd gone along with it because she was bursting to get on with her life and she needed something, anything, to happen. She knew she was going to break her father's heart. But first, she wanted to show him that she'd at least tried to be happy in the place she'd lived all her life. She'd done what she could. She'd auditioned for school plays and had been given tiny parts and watched from the wings while the talentless girls that the teachers loved forgot their lines and turned the only ones they remembered into nonsense. She'd been in the chorus line at the Winter Gardens and she'd gone to talk to a man at the local amateur dramatic society who told her that their next production was The Cherry Orchard, which probably wouldn't be her cup of tea. He asked whether she'd like to start off selling tickets and making posters. None of it was what she wanted. She wanted to be given a funny script so that she could make it funnier. She wished that she could be happy, of course she did. She wished she wasn't different. Her school friends and her colleagues in the cosmetics department at RHO Hills didn't seem to want to claw, dig, wriggle and kick their way out of the town like she did. And sometimes she ached to be the same as them. And wasn't there something a bit childish about wanting to go on television? Wasn't she just shouting, look at me, like a 2-year-old?
That was Funny Girl by Nick Hornby. Readers, when it comes to family relations, I bet all of us could write a book. So much grist for the mill. I hope you've enjoyed this lot. For more stories to keep you entertained, check my website, bookreportradio.com. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.